And good morning, and welcome to Word of Mouth, the program where captivating people talk about their unique jobs. I'm your host, Jim Wunderlich, and today I'll be chatting with Chris Cooling, a film professor at the College of Lake County. Chris has been teaching film classes at CLC since 2008. He has also curated a public series of recent international films since 2009. He received his PhD from the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts in 2006, and is here today to discuss the Oscar nominations. The Oscars will be broadcast on ABC TV Sunday evening, and Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for calling me captivating.
That's I'm off first. To a good start.
Yes.
So much to talk about. We're going to talk about the Oscars. That's what we're here for, but
sure.
A little bit of background. I'd like to back up a little bit. How did you get interested in film? What triggered your interest in film?
I could make that the entire hour, as you might imagine. You know, it was almost, destiny. It was always there. I grew up with my parents loving movies. But the way in which they loved movies involved this strange thing called a video cassette recorder and enjoying them at home. You know, so I remember when we would rent Star Wars and physically have the object, the mm-hmm. movie is in this cassette. That was exciting. If a James Bond movie or a Dirty Harry movie started playing in the other room while we were eating dinner, everyone would wordlessly pick up their plates and get up and walk into the living room. But they weren't as keen on going to see movies in the theaters. So I would hold out the newspaper and look at these ads that said, you could go watch these movies right now in a theater. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I would, try to have that sad Native American one tear going down his face commercial appearance and say, could we do this? And they said, well, we'll get it eventually. And so eventually I went to a junior high school in downtown Toronto. And Toronto has a pretty good film culture. It has
a
film festival.
Yeah.
And had many great theaters, most of which aren't there anymore, but many good sort of pseudo movie mm-hmm. palaces. And I skipped school as much as I could. I ran off to the circus and I kept going to movies. And so I was the worst student in the history of my school, or down there at least. But it became the one thing I did know about. You mm-hmm. know, it was a semi-private high school with a lot of brilliant people and has produced Canadian politicians and Nobel winners, and movies were the thing that I seemed somehow to know the most about, mm-hmm. and so I was able to hold on to that. And then I went to college and took every film course I could, and I said, what do I do with this degree?
Mm-hmm.
They said, keep taking classes and be a teacher and get paid to watch movies, read about movies, write about movies, and talk about movies, and that's the story.
I mean, you really went on. You went to USC.
That's right.
You got your PhD there.
That's right.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about the program there. That's pretty famous, the film school there.
It's good. It's the oldest film school in the country. It goes back to basically the silent era, and mm-hmm. even from that point, it had a kind of connection to the industry, that there was a sense of, let us set up a place where we can train people to keep our standards going. And
mm-hmm.
it was a really exciting place, given that I wanted to study Hollywood and American movies. It seemed, again, inevitable. It wasn't until graduate school that I'd been to Los Angeles. I think I'd been accepted there, NYU, a couple of other places.
Mm.
And all of those other places I had physically been to, and I'd never been to Los Angeles, and it just seemed, you've got to go to L.A. to study
Hollywood, right.
Hollywood, American movies. To start segueing into our Oscar discussion, I'd loved doing research at the Academy Library. So USC had quite a good library. You could always go to UCLA down the other side of the city to pick up things. But I loved the Academy Library. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has a library, the Margaret Herrick Library. I love doing research
now,
there.
Can anybody go in there, and or is that more of a private institution?
You have to join, I think. You've got to give them some information. You
mm-hmm.
get a card. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're very. They have some hoops to jump through because you're getting physical primary materials. So there were times they would bring me boxes, you would put on white gloves, and you'd be interacting with some of the same physical pieces of paper, you know, original typed up documents and memos that some of these studio heads and directors would have handled themselves. And
like just like maybe Buster Keaton or something, would there be? I mean, is there a lot of old stuff there as well?
Yeah, the stuff that I tended to find it had to do with censorship. So, you know, if any of my film and society students are listening, this is a preview of a couple of lectures from now. The Hays Code.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Yeah, the Hays Code got very particular. about how movies should be expressed and what you could show and what you couldn't. Mm-hmm. And all of those fights between the filmmakers and the Hays Code are documented. Mm-hmm. And those documents still exist, and you can get them at the Academy Library. So you could see people fighting. The I wrote a paper on Mildred Pierce, the Joan Crawford noir female melodrama, and it's based on a James M. Cain novel, which is, as you might imagine, more explicit. It's more sexual. It has more language that mm-hmm. wouldn't get in there. But no characters die in the book. And if you've seen the movie, you remember it's structured around a murder. There's a flashback, a guy is murdered, and then we find out what led up to this point. And the censors said, someone has to die to pay for all of this horrible, immoral behavior.
Oh, my goodness.
And so ironically, for censorship, there's more death in the movie because death was a way to punish extramarital sex, bad language, divorce, etc. So those were always fascinating conversations.
A little bit different now. When did that change occur, do you think?
Well, you can pinpoint it.
Was there a particular movie that just stretched the muscles of that?
Yeah, there are a few. I mean, the big change is 1968. And again, this is great. If you're in my film and society class, you should take notes now. And this will reinforce the lecture coming up in a couple of weeks. 68, we go to the rating system.
Okay.
So we get R at that point. There's G. It takes a while for you to get to PG. It's M and then GP and then mm-hmm. PG. Mm-hmm. So then you have an awareness that movies can have different levels of explicit content. But before that, it really was a production code that gave you a seal or no seal. And so movies had to be for everyone.
So everything was G or PG then?
It wasn't a rating. It was just physically a seal. Like you imagine the old comic books had the little seal of approval on the front
yes,
page.
Yes, yes.
That was it. There was a seal on the title card of the movie. If you look for it, you know where to look. You see a little marker saying this is the Production Code Administration.
So real quick, I know we're getting off topic a little bit, but it's kind of interesting, but a little bit. No, it's okay. The seal,
yes.
Would that mean no profanity, for example?
It would mean that the Motion Picture Association of America, all of the studios getting together, have collectively determined that this movie is good enough for everybody in America to see, and they are taking this on themselves so that the government or that local censorship boards don't do it, mm-hmm. and so you can trust us. They're always going to push it a little bit. Once you set a precedent, people will try to sneak past it. Famously, 1939, the last line of Gone with the Wind has the word D-A-M-N. I'm not going to say it on the radio, but if you're a good speller, you know what word it is.
Right.
And then, you know...
So that might have been it. That was the watershed moment.
I guess that's one of the a big early mm-hmm. precedent that other okay. people can cite and say, mm-hmm. you let Gone with the Wind get away with this. We spent as much money on this movie as that one, so you should let us get away with it.
Well, I tell you, maybe that does segue to the Oscars because we've come a long way since then. Mm-hmm. So let's take a look, and we'll turn our attention to the Oscars. And
can I jump in with my personal segue?
Absolutely.
When you hear it, you'll know why.
Absolutely. I love segues.
I've got a big piece of paper that says Oscars. We're not going to ignore it. But my personal segue, I had it in the back of my head, was mentioning the Margaret Herrick Library and going off on that tangent.
Sure.
I knew I could bring it back because they physically had the Oscar from All About Eve, best black and white costume design. Back when costume design had to be designed for black and white movies versus color. And I would pick it up. They would send someone to go get the documents, and while I would wait, I would walk over to a shelf and just hold an Oscar and pretend I was speaking and giving my speech. And I know the weight of the Oscar from going to the Academy Library. I don't know if that's allowed or if I just got away with it. It was quiet.
That is pretty cool.
That's my segue.
Now, I understand they're pretty heavy.
Yeah, they're solid. They feel pretty solid. You don't feel like there's chocolate inside. You're not going to peel anything off.
Okay, so now we're at the Oscars.
There you go.
And very good, yeah.
Thank you. Best picture.
So yes. Let's take a look, and I'll just kind of list them. American Hustle.
Yes.
Captain Phillips. Dallas Buyers Club. Gravity. Her. Nebraska. Philomena. 12 Years a Slave and The Wolf of Wall Street. By the way,
yes.
All wonderful films. I've seen most of them,
yes.
And I just think they're terrific. A great year this year.
It's a strong lineup.
Very. That's a way good way of putting it, yeah. So American Hustle, 12 Years a Slave, and Gravity in the last week mm-hmm. seem to be getting the most buzz. What are your thoughts about Best Picture?
Well, first of all, I'm
or
excited.
I should say American Hustle, too. Oh, go ahead, yeah.
Well, I can talk about that. Yeah. I mean, just as a lineup, it's probably one of the strongest lineups mm-hmm. I've seen in a while. It's surprising personally how close it is to my own tastes. Usually there are a couple of years where there's something that I find so bland and obvious and middle brow that I find myself wincing if it wins.
Yes.
And
yes,
this
good
year,
point.
Yeah. Yeah, this year there's nothing like that. The only one that I really don't like is The Wolf of Wall Street. But that's certainly not middlebrow or safe. I think that's a movie that's
there. Talk about the Hayes Code.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Holy moly.
We've come a long way.
Yeah.
That movie is, to me, a failed experiment, but you can't deny it's a bold experiment, and it's interesting that the Oscars still recognize it. I think that has a lot to do with the name Martin Scorsese. Mm-hmm. I think if someone else tried to do it, it wouldn't have as many Oscar nominations as it does.
What don't you like about it?
Well, to me, there's a monotony to it. It's a three-hour movie suggesting that these characters who do drugs and have sex with hookers should not be doing drugs and having sex with hookers, and that they are greedy. And I knew that before the movie started. I knew that once the movie's 3 hours began. I knew that as they ended. And I didn't feel that it was necessarily shedding any light or nuance. And I feel like I've yet to see a really good defense of it. I'd look for it because I like Martin Scorsese a lot, and it's certainly well made and has many individual funny sequences that are made by talented people. But to me, it is essentially pointless. And the reviews that I've seen that try to defend it say, if you're not getting pleasure out of this, you're dead from the waist down. You're a prude. And I say, I'm not. I like pleasure, but I also like variety. I like fudge, but I don't have it for 4 hours in a row. I take breaks and, you know, I digest and sip water. And it seems to be, I said to my wife afterwards, we both disliked it. I said, the only way to defend it is as kind of an avant-garde experiment, like Andy Warhol looking at the Empire State Building for 10 hours. It's just like, I felt like my dad was making me smoke a whole box of cigarettes to stop liking cigarettes, but I didn't like cigarettes in the first place and wasn't one caught.
A friend of mine said, if you like Caligula, you're going to like this. And
was pornography.
And I don't need to see that. Yeah. So I know you liked American Hustle.
Yes.
Why so? What'd you like about that?
Well, that for me is a great segue because they are opposite sides of a coin to me. They're both movies about similar subject matter, our greed, our desire to con, our desire to perform and lie and reinvent ourselves in the pursuit of greed. And they're both Scorsese-ish. One of them is literally Martin Scorsese's movie, and the other one, David O. Russell's, is the style of Goodfellas, Casino, the 70s, the period. And so that's a very fair, obvious, maybe, comparison point. But for me, American Hustle, this is where my pretension and PhD come in, I guess. It feels French to me. It reminds me of a lot of great French movies from the 30s by a man named Jean Renoir.
Right.
And if you, this is, would be a preview for my international class, I talk about poetic realism.
Well, sign me up.
Yeah, join us. It's just like this. The microphones are even larger. It's harder to see my face behind them, but other than that, it's exactly the same. Poetic realism is interesting historically because it comes right around World War II. And they are films that aren't really taking sides at a time when you might imagine history is screaming at you to say, take sides, instruct, direct. And they were very humane movies that found dimensionality in all of their characters. So where The Wolf of Wall Street to me is a monotonous movie, American Hustle is a very nuanced, complicated movie without clear heroes or villains where you sympathize with people and their flaws and their greed and their foibles.
Right.
You recognize that's the one that I think humanizes and makes understandable why you might make some of these decisions. And it's not cartoonish, even though it's exuberant. It's very stylish and energetic, but it's about our passions and desires in a way that's relatable, where I do feel both. I do want those pleasures. It also reminds me that I'm not dead from the waist down. It's very sensual, very, very much about the love of a good food and meal and drink and sex partner, if I'm allowed to hint at that human need that we all have. So I find it just nuanced. Eventually, it will settle down into some heroes, villains, but it's been slowly hustling you, making you love everybody that you haven't realized the tricks it's playing. And so to me, it's a movie of great sophistication, whereas The Wolf of Wall Street is just a failed experiment. It's a gamble that I admire that, for me, hasn't worked properly.
You know, American Hustle also had a sense of humor about itself. From the opening line, some of this may be true.
Right.
And
exactly.
I thought that was really, really fun.
I mean, I think it is listed under original screenplays, even though it's about Abscam, and I think it's indebted to other people's research into Abscam.
Right,
but it's taking it in such a peculiar, idiosyncratic direction that it is a thing unto itself.
So let's just turn real quick, though. 12 Years a Slave and Gravity seem to be getting buzz. What do you think? They have a chance at it? It sounds like you're an American Hustle fan.
Yeah,
from what I'm getting.
I am. I just, for me, it is the most nuanced and yet the most energetic and joyous. And to me, it really seems like it's an irresistible concoction for the Academy. It's a great showcase for many, many actors. Mm-hmm. And it's intelligent and playful and so many things at once. All of these movies are good. I think that Gravity is certainly going to get the special effects and other technical awards. And I think it has a shot for director just because mm-hmm. Alfonso Cuarón was so passionate and spent so much time doing it and seems to have single-handedly caused these technical innovations. But it is also, it's so small and minimalist. It's so almost allegorical that it's easy for some people to dismiss it as mm-hmm. such and say, well, the dialogue isn't always as realistic as it could be. And I think that's deliberate. You know, I mean, he co-wrote it with his son, so it does almost have the sense of a bedtime story fable, you know, that it's a woman who wants to get home. The irony is it's got as much story as a small hardcover children's book, you know.
I wanted
to get back. Yeah. But it's very elemental. I mean, it's mm-hmm. about rebirth. It's got a lot of umbilical imagery. You know, it's about so much about being connected to people by these cords and wanting to hold on and let go. And if you've seen it, you remember how much the landing back on Earth without spoiling it, someone survives to the end of the movie.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Sorry. You know, it wouldn't be up there if no one
survived.
I think
by now, with all the money it's made, most people have probably seen it if they're going to.
I'd imagine so. Yeah. But probably my parents haven't yet, and they'll listen to this, and I'm spoiling it. That's a rebirth. You know, it's very much about throwing off weight and getting mm-hmm. onto the water and standing up. And, I think sometimes certain voters are going to be a bit more literal-minded and say, I wish there was more story. It's easy to put Gravity in the category of the Avatar Titanic-type movie that is the incredible special effects achievement that it's easy to overlook what they are if they are doing anything in terms of storytelling, acting, and those qualities.
Well, a film that doesn't have special effects, or very, very few, mm-hmm. and comes to the gut, a great story, 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard not to walk away and be moved by that movie. Mm-hmm. And do you think that has a shot at winning it?
Certainly it has a shot. These are just my opinions,
right?
This radio show should not be used for the purpose of gambling.
But I am talking to a film professor who went to USC,
it's
too.
It's true.
So.
But if you scratch that too far under the surface, you'll realize I'm very hesitant about substituting my opinions for teaching. So if it becomes about what's it like having this job, there is a certain conflict for me to come in and talk about the Oscars and say, I have these opinions, as if, you know, the fact that you're putting a microphone in front of me suggests someone should care about the, And I got into teaching. You know, teaching is not writing movie reviews.
Right, which I did in
university. I did that for a while. And I got sick of the very witty, pithy pan of something saying, well, this movie is a pile of trash that shouldn't have been microwaved or some witty, hilarious way of saying if I didn't like it, I don't want to talk about it.
I only want
to talk about the movies that I really like, and I want to teach, and I want to bring in the students.
Sure.
And when I want to teach them, I want to get students talking and forming their opinions and articulating mm-hmm. them. And sometimes students say, tell me what you thought, as if to say, I should think. And I say, what I think is that you should develop your own interests and develop your own tastes, and even the Oscars for me should be taken with a grain of salt, as it's a start of your own personal journey to find your own tastes and compare them and to make it a conversation. I mean, I think that's why I'm here and why it's fun to do this.
I
have my opinions, but certainly you can see this piece of paper that I've circled some of the things that the winners that I think you'll get.
Back to 12 Years a Slave.
I was
going to
say none of which is anything specific.
It does get into it, though. That movie, to me, though, has such historical significance.
Yes, yeah.
And maybe kind of goes back to the point which Roots did in the 70s. We need to be reminded.
Yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I feel like in some ways that was part of my problem with it. As much as it is a very well-made, incredibly acted movie, I found myself wondering what was new about it, or what it exactly was saying about slavery that I didn't already know. Mm-hmm. And again, there's that sense of, well, you know, we still do not have a fully racially equitable world, and therefore we need to be reminded, and therefore, you know, a lot of people say that cinema is experiential rather than argument-driven, idea-driven always, that sometimes it's just cinema can make you physically feel, can make you sense and experience what that guy went through to a degree that reading the book couldn't, and that therefore that's why you should do it. It's a time travel device. It's an empathy device. It literally, the camera allows you to see through someone's eyes, and so you're getting that experience. And in that respect, of course, it's very visceral and well-made. Some of it for me is that I love the director Steve McQueen. His first movie, Hunger, is also about injustice. It's about the IRA imprisoned and the ways in which they would revolt, mm-hmm. and they would use their bodies and they would use human waste, and they, you know, one of them would go on this incredible hunger strike, and the other ones would make these sculptures out of, you know, feces on the walls. And so it became a movie that I thought was experiential and thoughtful, intellectual about what do we do, how do we respond to these structures. And it may just simply be that I haven't revisited it and that I'm not looking closely enough, and that this is just my flaw and subjective error, because I know that it's a very handsome, well-made movie, but I found myself a little bit hungry for the feeling of an artist telling me, here is what new ideas I have to shed on the light of how slavery works and what it means for people.
But a historical film can do that.
Absolutely.
And we had a lot of historical-based films this year.
Yeah.
I think it was 6 out of the 9 films were based on some sort of actual or historical person. Wolf of Wall Street, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, right. 12 Years a Slave, Philomena, and American Hustle.
Yeah.
Is this a trend, do you think? Because last year we had Lincoln and Argo, of course.
Yeah.
Why do producers embrace that, do you think?
I like the question because there are many right answers. And it's not a question you can definitively answer easily with one idea.
But it seems to be a trend.
Yeah. I mean, that would require statistics, you know, to sit back and say, I wonder, you know, and I haven't done that amount of homework. But I think that to me, it's always been there in some degree. And then you can always go the cynical answer. And certainly the Oscars are a nice occasion to get cynical and say it's a big advertising campaign for the industry, which it literally is. It's a way to raise money for the Academy to do some of its other fundraising and support things like that library that I quite liked. So you could cynically say basing movies and rewarding movies that are based on real subjects are a nice public relations stunt to convince the world that movies are healthy and educational and they are tools that you should bring into your classroom. And then you could extend that argument and say in the future all education will be taught by Hollywood movies. Teachers won't be necessary. The movies will be so good that they will give you those experiences. So that's a very cynical answer, and some people feel that way. And there may, you know, I think the question shows that there's truth in so many directions. The other, I think, that strikes me is that it's a generational issue. A lot of these are about pasts that we might recognize, that we might be able to talk about with our younger family members. Hmm. And so there's a kind of joy. This is also something I talk about in my classes. In that,
that's an interesting viewpoint.
Yeah. That's why I talk about it in my classes. I like this one. This is. I was proud that I discovered this. Some of my students might know or might already be sick of me talking about something I call the operational aesthetic, which is a style of engaging with culture where the audience member debates whether they saw something true or not, whether it was real. And it goes back to P.T. Barnum, the way that he would say, here are a bunch of exhibits. There's a platypus and there's a mermaid. And the mermaid would be a monkey stapled to a fish. Which is, you know, as close as you're going to get to the non-existent mermaid, but platypuses are real. And so people would go see the shows and they wouldn't complain and they wouldn't riot. They would accept it and say, I enjoyed debating what he got right and what he got wrong. I enjoyed participating in how true this object was. And that goes to other things like Ripley's Believe It or Not in the newspaper. The fun is debating it. It's right there in the title, Believe It or Not. And we seem to have this habit of enjoying, did they get that right? Is that true? And so you can do that with these movies based on historical fact. You can participate. Even if it's something like Lincoln, you can show off your knowledge of history. You can say, I remember this. I'm a history buff. And they got this exactly right, but they were a little bit anachronistic about these details. And it's a great tangible way to have that conversation going. And the way in which I talk about it in class is that conversation is a more comfortable conversation than is it good art or not. And that might be where I struggle with 12 Years a Slave to a degree that others don't and that others celebrate it, because by the operational aesthetic, it seems masterful. It seems an absolute time travel device that puts you into this experience.
Time travel. I like that. Yeah. That's what they do.
Mm-hmm. But then as a work of art, that's just such a difficult question. It's easier to say they got that detail right. They didn't. The people in the 70s didn't really have hair that big. Not that many. If you look at American Hustle, you can debate to what extent everybody wore those costumes or didn't. But the question of what makes something a work of art is really difficult. And
well, let's take an artistic film, because it was done in black and white.
Yes.
Alexander Payne's Nebraska. Yeah,
lovely movie.
And not historical.
No.
So, your impressions?
For me, I love that movie dearly, and for me that...
In a black and white.
Yes.
That takes a little bit of courage when you put out a black and white movie. I mean, the last one I saw that got any recognition was The Artist.
Yeah, but that's not that long ago.
Right, but if you go before that, it's been many, many years.
Right. The Coen brothers made The Man Who Wasn't There in black and white. And
was that Oscar nominated?
No, I don't think for anything.
Gotcha, Chris.
Yes, sorry. Sometimes, right, okay. I forgot. Okay, so the movies that the Oscars...
But back to the... No, back, I don't... Hey, back, right, right. I'm not going to about to top you here.
Back to gotcha questions. I read everything, Jim.
I know. Hey, you've got the PhD.
Thank you.
Back to Nebraska, though. Yeah. Your impressions of it.
I really adore it. The black and white you ask about, I think it's trying to evoke an older style of American cinema, and the really big clue when you watch it is that Alexander Payne makes sure to use... a much older Paramount Studio logo when the movie starts.
You're right.
And I have a soft spot for directors who do that. David Fincher and Steven Soderbergh and a few others love to sort of bring up. American Hustle, I think, started with the 80s era Columbia logo.
Yeah.
And I always feel when I see those that I'm in good hands. I'm probably in the hands of someone around my age who cares about movies that I did, I guess. These guys are all sort of 40-something.
But Nebraska's kind of slow, too.
Yes.
It's black and white. It's slow.
Right.
And it's in Nebraska.
Yeah. To me, it feels like a great American short story, that I picked up a collection of short stories and that this is something that you could tell in maybe 20 to 30 pages, and then on screen you can live in it, and then you can devote time to just the haunting, very moving, just musical score. Mm. I was surprised that's a snub.
Yeah.
And it feels lived in and regional, and it feels that way in a way that we would have seen more of in the 70s. And one of the big ones in the 70s is The Last Picture Show, black and white,
right,
small
right.
town nostalgia. And so this is a movie that is sort of using some of that nostalgia for a way in which movies used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then by casting Bruce Dern, of course, you're going to get connections to Coming Home and
some of his great
performances from that era when he's a leading man. But I, you know, it's the type of movie that is one where I do want to say, trust me, trust my opinion, go see it. I don't want to spoil it too much.
So that's one you would highly recommend.
Absolutely. As a story, and this will make my wife embarrassed when she hears this, so I'll give her the warning to turn off the radio. I described the summary to her. She's 8 months pregnant now, so she can't get out to she's not going out to movies as much. I'll sneak off because it's my job. But I described the ending to her. I told her the whole story, and I said it ends in this very moving way, and she was in tears just from my description of it. So that's not a bad... I thought that was a pretty good review of how...
Oh, that's a wonderful review.
How strong the story is, yeah.
I tell you, we are just... I'm enjoying this immensely.
Thank you,
and,
so am
I. Just so much fun to have you here. By the way, if you're just joining us, I am talking to Chris Cooling.
That's me.
Film professor at the College of Lake County, and when we come back... We'll continue our conversation with Chris regarding the Oscars, including Best Actor and Best Actress. You're listening to Word of Mouth. Don't go away. And you're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. And in the background, you're hearing, that's actually a song from Frozen, Let It Go by Idina Menzel, and apparently that may win Best Song this year, Chris, in the Oscars.
Yeah, first of all, that was us singing it. I think you want to be sure that's what we get up to during the break. We just have so much excitement. I mean, it really seems like a lock. I know the other song, Happy, is a very popular sort of radio bouncy tune, but this one seems really both a strong song that deserves it and the type of song that's going to appeal to the Academy. It's very old-fashioned Broadway-style, musical style. So it seems like it's Disney's to lose on that.
Yeah, really catchy. It makes me want to see the movie, actually.
You should.
Yeah.
You should. Yeah.
Tell you what, we were talking about Best Picture before the break, and before we go on to Best Actor, and we'll get to that in just a second. Any films that you think in that category of Best Picture, any snubs or ones that should have been recognized? Do you have any one that in particular? I do, but I'd like you to share yours first.
Mine's obscure. Some of my students from last semester would have seen it. I took it into class, and I don't know specifically about Best Picture. For me, it was one of my favorite movies of last year, and it was a small independent movie called Upstream Color. And it was almost a handmade movie by an independent filmmaker. Gosh, I'm trying to remember his name. Shane Carruth is his name. He made Primer about 9-10 years ago in Texas out of his garage for about $7,000. And it was a brilliant time travel movie. Upstream Color is just as intelligent, but it's also formally beautiful. It's very well shot and has lovely music that the film.
So how would a person like myself see that? I don't remember that even being at the Landmark in Renaissance or the Renaissance Theater. They show independent films.
Yeah, this is self-distributed, so it didn't have that wide a release. It played in Chicago at the Music Box. So if you're a local listener and you want this sort of thing on your radar, you need to be willing to travel to Chicago for some of these things. Mm-hmm. Certain, not everything gets a play at the at the Highland. But it's incredibly well made and edited, and I really thought that they would give him an editing nomination. And I thought that would have been a way for the editors to acknowledge that this guy is really putting a lot of effort and doing intelligent, creative, intellectual things with his editing that are also still very moving and mysterious and intellectually gripping. Because the way in which the nominations work are the people within the category nominate their own. So the composers will nominate their own fellow musicians and composers for best
score. Yeah, let's talk about that for a second. How does that work?
Yeah, within the individual categories, if you freeze frame Sunday night at the end, even though you'll be a little tipsy and tired, there will be some instructions on the screen or some rules about how they nominate. And they may even say it. They'll say, nominations are announced by the members of the category and the winners themselves are determined by popular ballot. Each of those categories is meant to be, here are the five screenplays as the fellow writers in the Writers Guild have determined. Here are the five best examples of cinematography. And so that's why you'll see things like The Grandmaster sneak in Achievement in Cinematography. You might say, I haven't seen this. It's not really nominated anywhere else. But according to the cinematographers, this is a great example of cinematography. And so they want to at least give that the nomination. It probably won't win because not as many people saw it. And the winners are determined by everybody voting.
Mm-hmm.
So that becomes the trick. But I really thought even just a nomination for this guy's editing. He's in the movie. He directed it. He wrote it. He shot it. He edited it, scored it. And I think it's a really brilliant, intelligent, moving film that it's true. I don't think it would have ever been the Academy's taste to give it a Best Picture nomination. But to have the editor say, mm-hmm. this is a guy who's just taught himself editing. We can learn from him. He deserves, he's a guy who's making these movies self-financed.
So how old is he?
He's in his mid-30s now.
Okay.
Mid to late 30s. And
the title and his name again, just...
Sure. It's called Upstream Color, and his name is Shane Carruth. And it took him way too long to make his second movie. And any recognition by peers, I think, and in this case I would have thought fellow editors would see this guy's a brilliant editor, would have been a great way to help this guy get some more funding and just keep making more interesting movies, even, and so that some of them will make it up to the Highland Park.
And to get the recognition.
Yeah.
Did you see Fruitvale Station?
Yes, I did. Yes,
see, I thought that was very powerful.
I have to admit, a lot of people would say they're surprised that it's not on here. And that is another one, I think, that walks that interesting line between documenting something, absolutely giving you that experiential opportunity to just be in a human being's shoes, and yet still tries to articulate a point of view where you feel the influence of an artist saying, I want to tell you these things. So it's about the fatal shooting of an African-American young man on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day morning at a BART stop in the Bay Area in San Francisco. And
that's like our L.
Yeah, you know. The public transit, coming home from parties, etc. Mm-hmm. And just the absolute unnecessary pointlessness of a presumably poorly trained public transit security guard, just, you know, being trigger happy. And the movie is just a very...
Which kind of, I guess I read, goes back to the mayor.
Was it?
He wanted them to start carrying guns.
Right.
And they weren't trained at, like, you know, policemen, et cetera. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, yeah. It's interesting that I don't...
But that all kind of comes out of in the movie later on. And
right.
I guess if you start to read more about it, it ignites something in you after you see it, anger, actually.
But it's very rigorously about the victim and his day.
Yes.
And it's not, you could easily tell the same story in which the mayor is a character, the cop is a character.
Mm-hmm.
You see the political pressure that leads to the mayor's decision. You see the lack of training and the anxiety over the guy who's got the gun. And it really is just kind of, we've pointlessly lost a life. And so let us use cinema to document it, to try and reconstruct it, to try and, you know, perpetuate it, literally, just make it come alive so that we can, you know, honor it. And I think that becomes a kind of experiment, too, to just say we're not necessarily going to make this political or an argumentative film, and yet we will let you decide the extent to which it is.
Mm-hmm.
You can say this life had value even though it might seem mundane. It might seem not worthy.
It's a slice of life.
Right. In some ways, it doesn't seem... a traditional movie. We're just watching a man try to be a good man, go about his life, handle his work.
But he's not perfect. He's human.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so, you know, I mean, we were talking about black and white Oscar movies, and I mentioned Schindler's List, and that was one that people debate. Anytime you get to the Holocaust specifically, you'll get people debating what is the right way for a movie to address this subject matter. How are you being sensitive or insensitive? Mm-hmm. Is there a right or wrong way to do it? And Fruitvale Station is definitely taking an experiment and saying, you know, we lost a life and a movie can give life back to it and can, you know, can be a kind of memorial just for a single life, you know.
That kind of does segue to Best Actor, because the performance by Michael B. Jordan in Fruitvale Station was worthy of a nomination, but you only have five. It's very, very difficult, but he was wonderful in it.
Right.
And I think we're going to see more of him in the years to come.
That's absolute. Yeah. I mean, definitely it's a talented movie made by people. I mean, I forget the name of the director, but he, out of Sundance, he's out of USC as well.
That's right. He's like 25 years old, too, I believe.
Yeah, and
he managed
to get Forrest Whitaker to put some funding based on... And
right.
I think, you know, if I'm right and his background is USC, then he's going to have made some short films there and he's going to be able to take some stuff to Sundance. USC will help get their students over to Sundance to network. And so that's a pretty good success story that inevitably is going to lead to more things by this young man.
Yeah, I guess he handed Forrest Whitaker his screenplay.
Right.
And so he happened to look at it and boom.
Yeah.
Okay, back to Best Actor.
Okay.
And let's take a look. We have Christian Bale for American Hustle.
Right.
Bruce Dern, Nebraska, and we talked about him a little bit. Leonardo for The Wolf of Wall Street. Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Got it.
12 Years a Slave. And Matthew McConaughey, Dallas Buyers Club.
Yes.
Gosh, great performances by all those people.
Absolutely.
And what do you think?
Well,
just terrific.
First to finish with Michael Jordan, Michael B. Jordan, that he should be there too, and it sort of speaks to why are you willing to extend the picture nominations to 9 or 10 or less than 9?
Yeah.
Know, if there are only 3 or 4 songs, we'll only have 3 or 4 songs. If you want to make it 6 1 year or 4 1 year, you know, you could be more fluid. So that's something to throw out in terms of thinking about the structure, but in terms of
the Oscars, an improvement, right?
I would say just my instinct and opinion is that, like so many others, you cannot avoid the McConaissance, as they call it.
What it's called?
I've seen it. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing it correctly. I wish I could take credit for it.
I have not seen that. I thought you just invented that.
I wish I could. I would love to take credit. But no, I mean, they're all great actors, Oscar-worthy. Bruce Dern, you know, always you have the option of the sentimental vote. But in some cases, the nomination is the award. Robert Forster and Burt Reynolds are both up for it in 97 with Jackie Brown and Boogie Nights. And in many cases, there's a sense of, let's redeem a career or let's save somebody. And then Robin Williams gets it for Good Will Hunting. And so I think that for Bruce Dern, that nomination is going to be the award. I think Leonardo DiCaprio has been nominated a few times and will go on to be. He's clearly a major star, consistently works with Martin Scorsese. Yes, this is perhaps more energetic and more committed and brave than previous performances, but I don't think it's his year simply. And so I think in terms of the performance in the movie, it would be down to Chiwetel Ejiofor and Matthew McConaughey. And they're...
Boy, talk about two different...
Yeah.
Apples and oranges.
It's a tough decision, and it's interesting to try and get in the heads of the voters and say, what is that decision? It would be great. 12 Years a Slave is certainly a movie that, you know, we're going to have to honor. I think it's going to get the director's award and probably screenplay, if I recall, maybe even supporting actress. But with Chiwetel Ejiofor, he's a great actor who's been around for a while.
Until now, I don't think he really had the publicity.
And that would be what we would give to him. The award would give him a different career. The award would give him make him a consistent leading man. You know, would be a really great thing for his career to a degree that Matthew McConaughey doesn't need. He doesn't need the award, but McConaughey.
Okay, we just got the butt.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
He doesn't need it, but I think some people are going to say, yeah, maybe Chiwetel Ejiofor, it would help his career more, but that's not the point of the Oscars. The point is to honor the best work. And this is a guy who's just so consistently reinvented himself in the last few years with Mud, Magic Mike, Killer Joe, Dallas Buyers Club, even his work on True Detective.
Yeah,
I'm obsessed with it. It's really using his weight loss well in haunting ways. And I think that there's a certain phenomenon to him as an actor that is going to be irresistible to the Academy in that...
Well, let's talk about his role.
Okay.
Who does he play? Since you're going to go with him, let's talk a little bit about his role in Dallas Buyers Club.
He plays a man named Ron Woodruff, who you would call a hard liver. I don't know about the actual liver. He drinks a lot. Maybe he would be a hard liver. But a hard-living gentleman in Texas who would be, you know, a drug user, promiscuous, and in the early days of the AIDS epidemic is given the HIV-positive diagnosis at a time when it's so early and little known and little understood that it's perceived as the quote-unquote gay plague. And so he is torn between his own, you know, latent homophobia. He's not necessarily a completely irredeemable bigot, but he's very defensive about his masculinity. He's the type of homophobe who is homophobic because he sees homosexuals as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he refuses to say die, and he's going to find a way to get the medicines that he needs. And again, this Dallas Buyer Club, he initiates to get medicines from across the border in Mexico. And so it's kind of got all of them. It's got all of the Oscar go-tos. It's got a substantial weight loss. He's playing someone who's wasting away to AIDS, and so he loses a frightening, unhealthy amount of weight for the role. He's based on a real person.
It is really haunting.
Yeah, Ron Woodruff. And yeah. And it's a big social statement, you know. So it's got all those things, and it's got the weight of the McConaughey reinvention behind it, that it seems like a juggernaut. Certainly, it's easy to imagine him coming back. It's certain that his career is going to keep going. He's had this great run, and that maybe Chiwetel Ejiofor might not. He might easily return to cable television and smaller movies. So it's an interesting debate. I think it would be down to those guys. But at some point, I want to talk about Matthew McConaughey as a kind of Burt Reynolds figure. Who's been this kind of Southern good old boy and had these fun performances and then has reinvented himself a little bit.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I like that.
You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Jim Wunderlich, and I'm talking to Chris Cooling, film professor at the College of Lake County. We'll be back right after this. Now there's a song that gets you psyched up for the Oscars, huh?
Yes. It makes me miss the bandwagon. I want to watch that again.
That's entertainment. That's Rufus Wainwright, and that's his version. Just joining us, we're talking to Chris Cooling, a film professor at College of Lake County, and we were just talking about Matthew McConaughey.
Yes.
And you think he's going to win Best Actor, and you wanted to say one more thing about him.
Well, I do feel like it is a kind of, for me, it's a Burt Reynolds narrative in that he could have gone that way, and that Burt Reynolds was someone who was a major movie star, incredibly charming, and almost kind of lost his way to hedonism. both in his, I guess, personal life, but also on screen. You know, he
Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah, and then making, you know, sequels to them, and then Stroker Aces and Hoopers and things that a lot of people would say, well, he's coasting so far, and that he would still make things like Deliverance and The Longest Yard, and that he would try, and that he just almost seemed to fumble, that he couldn't quite get the timing right. And Matthew McConaughey really seemed like he was going in that direction with so many romantic comedies in a row that seemed so disposable.
And Sahara.
Exactly. Yeah. Where it just seemed like it seemed like he was phoning them in and just coasting on his persona. And now to blow us away with all of this talent, it's almost a relief to see that this guy has made such a course correction. I think that's going to be on people's minds when they cast their ballots.
Yeah, and Mud. I would recommend that too.
Absolutely.
Which he was in. Let's go to Best Actress.
Yes.
The nominees are Amy Adams, American Hustle, Cate Blanchett, Blue Jasmine, Sandra Bullock, Gravity, Judi Dench, Philomena, and Meryl Streep, August, Orange County.
Osage,
pardon me. Yeah. Tracy Letts, I'm sorry, yeah. But powerful film, by the way. Yeah.
Still didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
I know.
Well, anyway, no problem, but of the ones you did see and have heard about and read, certainly, who do you think?
I mean, I do think it's Cate Blanchett's. I think that...
she seems to be the odds-on favorite right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those... You know, I would say this about... how confident I am. If you are indeed using this radio show as a way to make your selections for your Oscar pools, that's going to be the one that everybody votes on and is almost a lock. And then you're going to have those other categories. You need to get a long shot somewhere. You know, you need to get one that
Judi Dench.
And no one doesn't. Yeah, it would be interesting. Mm-hmm. You may want to use this category as the one where you go nuts. I would say maybe Amy Adams could do it.
Mm.
That she's been working very consistently. She's great in American Hustle. It could be an upset. Cate Blanchett has already won. She got Best Supporting Actress for playing Katharine Hepburn in The Aviator. And, you know, I'm fuzzy on the timing of when the votes have to be in. But, you know, there has been a recent controversy over the film's maker, so that may have influenced people, and that might be a reason to say, you know, enough, and let's give it to...
Yeah, we could get into the whole Woody Allen thing, but we'll have to see if...
that's its own hour.
Art trumps everything in that case.
Yeah, I mean, it would... You know, these are the people who... I mean, it's interesting that they gave the Lifetime Achievement Award to Elia Kazan, and that some people sat on their hands that Kazan named names during the blacklist.
Yeah.
So it seemed a way in which the Oscars would say, we're just about the art here. You know, you made this great art, and we're going to discuss that. We're going to honor that and not your personal decisions. So if you call that a precedent, then presumably Woody Allen will continue making, you know, strong movies as he has, and, you know, they'll keep getting Oscar nominations. But it would be interesting to see. You know, every passing year, the body gets a little bit younger of Oscar voters, so it's conceivable. That might be the one where you say, I want to gamble on that upset, even though it seems like she's a runaway train. She is incredible in it.
All great performances, but you think that Cate Blanchett is the lock in terms of the Office pool.
It really does seem that way, and that you've got one of those great performances where she's convincing as a character, but she's also someone that is lying to herself, and so she is herself a performer. And she gets to show you the cracks of who she really is underneath the facade that she presents to the world, that she sort of represents the kind of sheltered, wealthy person who has to protect themselves with a public self. And that, you know, that last shot of her.
Yeah, maybe that'll be a spoiler alert there.
I will hold back.
You know, speaking of great performances, and one of the things that the Oscars will do, the in memoriam.
Yes.
And we lost one of the greats. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I heard that, I started to think of what my favorite performances were. When you think of him, what's one of the performances that comes to mind?
Well, it says a lot about him that my answer is actually four movies instead of one movie.
Yes,
you know,
and he would, in terms of supporting actor
and lead.
Or lead, I mean, it didn't matter.
You know, if you ask me for personal opinions, I would just say the warm-hearted nurse that he plays in Magnolia is something that I would want to watch again for sentimental reasons, and it's the one I want to believe is the real Philip Seymour Hoffman on some level, even though, you know, it's a performance. After he passed away, I found myself recommending two movies that he'd made, both about addiction. And one of them is called Owning Mahoney, which is about gambling addiction. And the other one is Love, Liza, that is about using substance abuse to deal with mourning. And now, in light of his death and how he died, you know, it's going to be painful, but it's going to be interesting to go back to those and think about what he's bringing to those. But in terms of just, you know, if I had to put one on to show to my students and say, let's study him, I would go with The Master. I like that movie a lot. And that's a movie that I want to defend in
which he won the Oscar for.
He's nominated for
it. Oh, he's nominated.
Yeah, okay. It's too weird. Okay. It's a very oddball movie. And it's the type of movie I look forward to teaching in class and figuring out and uncoding. And he's great in it. It's the one where he's playing a kind of a Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard type character. And, you know, as much as you might find the movie odd, the scenes between him and Joaquin Phoenix just interrogating each other and breaking each other down are some of the most riveting bits of acting you can ever find. So,
tell you what, we're running out of time, but maybe one last question before we go.
Let's cancel all other shows and just go on the rest of the day.
I tell you, we could go on and on, seriously.
Yeah.
But the Oscars are coming up on Sunday night.
Yes.
And afterwards, we'll all say, geez, that was 3 hours too long.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do to improve the Oscars? And I don't know about in terms of time, but just the overall content, what would you do to improve the Oscars?
You know, it's funny. None of my suggestions would shorten them. One thing you could do to shorten them is occasionally they'll do this. They'll just give an award to a movie. So, for example, Gravity this year is going to win for best visual effects, you know. And so they might have industry reasons for nominating other movies, saying, well, these people worked hard on The Lone Ranger. A lot of money was invested in that. But still, you know Gravity's going to get it. When I remember as a kid, I liked Total Recall, and they just gave it a special award for visual effects that year. They didn't nominate anyone else, and so they just said that was so inventive. You can save time and streamline the show a little bit if there are certain things where an Avatar, a Gravity are such runaway juggernauts, just give them a special award and that way you're saving yourself some time. My other suggestions involve adding things, though. I think there should be, I love opening title design sequences, opening credits. I love that as an art form from the Saul Bass days with Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, Psycho, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And James Bond movies
Yes.
I'd love to see that honored.
That's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I'm
surprised. Because that's so creative.
I know. I mean, not every movie does it, but not every movie has a song that could get nominated. So to me,
exactly.
That's an art form I just adore.
By the way, you kind of hear the music. We're kind of doing that Academy Award thing right now.
I always hear music in my head, though, and talk to myself about movies.
Hey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for
inviting
me.
This has been so much fun, and maybe we can come back again and talk about summer movies when they come out.
I would love to do that.
Oh, boy. If you wish to contact Chris Cooling, go to the CLC website, www.clcillinois.edu. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you'll drop by again next Thursday at 11 a.m. when we talk to another captivating guest on Word of Mouth.